This is Audible.
Welcome to the audiobook of Models, a comprehensive guide to attracting women by Mark Manson. I am Mark Manson. Quick legal notice, this is copyright 2011 by myself. All rights are reserved. This publication may not be reproduced, transmitted by any form or means, mechanical, electronic, blah, 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 blah. And also legal notice, the purchaser and or listener of this publication, that would be you, assumes all responsibility for the use of this material and information. Adherence to all applicable laws and regulations, federal, state, local, or any other jurisdiction is the sole responsibility of the purchaser or reader. Basically what that means is, if you listen to this and then go out and rape, kill, maim, or molest somebody, it is your fault, not mine, and you can't hold me responsible. This is the introduction section of the book. I will be reading this obscenely long book to you over the course of the next few hours. Any questions or concerns, you can reach me at mark@practicalpickup.com. And of course, I encourage you to check out my website if you have not, at mark@practicalpickup.com. So with no further ado, let us begin. Introduction, movement. In our post-industrial, post-feminist world, a clear model of how to be an attractive man has been lost. Centuries ago, a man's role and duty was power and protection. Decades ago, it was to provide. But now, we're not quite sure. We're either the first or second generation of men that grew up without a clear definition of our social roles and without models of what it is to be strong and attractive men. 5 years ago, when I first began coaching men on improving their relationships with women, I had no idea the rabbit hole of information and development I was about to go down, both for myself and for others. At the time, the primary concerns of my dating life mostly revolved around which drink specials were going on that Tuesday night, and which one of the five Jennas in my phone was the one I met last weekend. It wasn't until I sat down and tried to get other men to the point where they had five Jennas in their phone that I began to get a glimpse of how deep a man's social and emotional development actually goes, and how difficult it is to inspire a genuine shift. I won't lie, in hindsight, getting myself to that point seems easy now by comparison. Growing up, I had always been somewhat of an average guy, although I had little luck with the ladies. Then in 2005, after being cheated on and left by my first serious girlfriend and first love, I was emotionally distraught and slightly traumatized. I became obsessive. A desperate need for validation and affection from women arose within me, and I spent an inordinate amount of time pursuing that validation and affection, far more than most men ever do. I was overcompensating, and soon became driven to sleep with every girl who would let me anywhere near her in the Boston area. This went on for a little more than 2 years. My plan wasn't sophisticated. Really, I read a couple books like this one and basically went out to bars 4 or 5 nights a week, approaching, flirting and failing, pushing and pulling, fucking and floundering for those 30 glorious months of experimentation. It was self-indulgent, but it was a time of growth and a time of movement. But a couple of years and a few dozen women later, two things happened. First, I began to realize that rampant drunken sex was fun, but not very fulfilling. It began to get old, and it wasn't exactly affecting the other areas of my life in a healthy manner. I was required to let up and evaluate myself, to question why I was sacrificing so much time and effort into such superficial pleasures. The second thing that happened was I had grown a reputation locally for my exploits. Soon men whom I had never met were emailing me, asking me if they could come hang out with me, to see how I interacted with women. It was weird at first, but then I decided, sure, why not? Just buy my drinks and give me a little money on the side. And strangely, I feel like that's where the real journey began. To try to model the internal movement that occurred within myself and then replicate it in other men. They say if you want to master something, teach it. And this second journey actually ended up being far more educational than the first. When I went out for myself, it was easy. Half the time I was going out to lose myself, to bury my emotions, and hopefully wake up in the arms of a stranger. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, and that's all I really knew. But this second journey had a purpose. It had a meaning, and suddenly needed an intellectual foundation. I couldn't just do it anymore. I had to teach it, explain it, and impart it on the others and get them to do it. This led me in a winding, twisted path. It began with entries and exits from the so-called pickup artist community, and thousands of accumulated hours of talking and carousing and teaching. There were models about models and pages about pages, but quickly that path went dead, and I took excursions through social psychological studies, historiographies on human sexuality, strip club binges, research on NLP and cognitive therapy, various self-help seminars, hotel rooms with runway models, touch healing and alternative therapy mishaps, arguments with feminists, and shitty books on pop spirituality and pseudopsychiatry. The coaching grew, and soon it took me to more than a dozen cities across America, then to countries in Europe, to England and Australia, and I even took field trips as far as Argentina, Brazil, Israel, and Thailand, where I discovered that much of what I had always assumed about women was merely cultural. It was a period of immense education and drive, where I made a clear point to not let my thinking be confined by any previous model or paradigm about masculinity or male-female sexuality. And after all of that, over the last 5 years, this is what I've come back with. There are two movements occurring right now. The first one is a greater movement, a social and emotional movement in Western culture. There's a call for a new masculinity that's been lacking for generations now. There's been a void of what men are and what they're supposed to be, how they're supposed to behave, and the men's dating advice industry has largely moved to fill that void, for better or worse. This book aims merely to be another piece of that, a healthy, integrated piece, but a piece nonetheless. The second movement is happening within you personally. It's an emotional movement. You're reading this because you want to change. You want to change your interactions and your relationships with the women in your life. You want these relationships to improve. You want these relationships to be abundant. You want to feel confident and empowered around women, those you know and those you don't know but want to meet. You want to feel in control of your relationships with them. You want to be sexual with them without shame or hesitation or regret or pain. The second movement is an internal movement. It took me a long time to come to grips with that. Although the second movement often begins by changing outer behavior and results in a change of outer behavior, the process itself is an internal one, a shift of emotional disposition, which in turn affects one's social life and love life. This book is designed to guide you through that internal movement. The larger social movement is merely a backdrop and is only briefly explained to give context to your current situation. Your failures with women aren't happening because you say the wrong thing or because you don't look good enough. Well, that's not true. You are saying the wrong things and probably don't look good enough yet, but these are symptoms of the problem, not the problem itself. Your failures happen because you grew up emotionally ill-equipped to deal with women and intimacy. The words you say and the looks you have are merely a side effect of that. If this sounds like some sort of inner game diatribe, please don't be mistaken. I'm interested in real-world behaviors with real-world consequences, but this isn't just about intellectually understanding how to stand, how to talk, how to behave. This isn't, quote-unquote, faking it until you make it. It's deeper than that. This is about intellectually learning the behaviors that will cause your emotions to shift, to create a permanent and unconscious route to being the attractive male that you can be. This is that how-to guide. This book aims to arm you with the behaviors that will form the emotional foundation you never received in adolescence, to present the masculine model you and I missed out on. And once you begin this internal shift, you'll find that the social actions, saying the right thing, knowing when to go for the kiss, knowing how to approach a woman, etc., they will all begin to fall into place, and fall into place in a more profound and powerful way than simply memorizing some lines or following some sort of arbitrary procedure. The beginning of this book is very theoretical. It's the big picture stuff. I do this because I think it's important to lay a foundation to explain the realities of attraction, masculinity, and femininity, and what determines your value on the dating market as a man. As the book goes on, though, it becomes more and more technical and specific, slowly honing in on necessary actions and habits. I believe it's important to explain why I'm having you do certain actions and behaviors first. Part one is an honest look at female attraction based on scientific research and the realistic consequences of that research in modern life. Part two is an overview of the dating strategy that I recommend to all men who come to me for help. The strategy focuses on polarizing reactions from women to screen for the ones most receptive to your identity as soon as possible. We also deal with the painful reality of rejection and how everyone must learn to deal with it. This is a reality-based strategy, not based on fantasies or frivolities of wanting to sleep with every woman you meet or dating a Victoria's Secret model by coming up with a script of pickup lines. These things are both unrealistic and horribly insecure. Part two is a long-term strategy built to take a man from no women in my life to lots of amazing women in my life, as quickly as possible and with as little effort as possible. Rejection plays an unavoidable part of that process, as we'll see. Part three is the first part of our strategy and covers the first of the three fundamentals laid out in chapter seven, building an enjoyable lifestyle and becoming an attractive man. The steps laid out in this part will be specific, but will be long-term goals with long-term benefits. Part four covers developing courage and becoming a man of action. Men are expected to initiate in all phases of courtship, the reasons why, which are explained in part one, and therefore a man who is hesitant, anxious, or afraid of initiating will never get anywhere with women. The advice laid out in this step will require diligence but provide real and lasting change for those willing to dedicate themselves. These steps are medium-term goals with medium-term benefits. Finally, part five will cover the nuts and bolts of communicating more effectively, more attractively, more openly, and more sexually. The steps laid out in this section should have immediate short-term effects. My goal is to provide you both with in-depth perspective into your emotions and how you operate, while also giving you practical processes for improving yourself and achieving your goals. If you're looking for a book full of say this line and execute touch plan X4Z-3, then you're going to be disappointed. But not only are you going to be disappointed in this book, you're going to be disappointed with every book that gives advice like that, because they are Band-Aid solutions. Until you learn to trust your own actions and learn to pursue women with your own unique style and personality, you have learned absolutely nothing. This book aims to give you your first real education on women and attraction, the education you should have received a long time ago from a number of sources, but never did. And I'll give you a free preview. It has little to nothing to do with what you're saying. It has everything to do with body, expression, emotion, and movement. A couple years ago, I was in Argentina. There I made one of the most important discoveries in all my time doing this. I saw a girl at a club sitting by herself. She looked upset. And when I approached her, she didn't get any happier. She didn't speak English, and I barely spoke any Spanish at the time. She didn't want to dance and didn't want to talk to me. She kept shaking her head and motioning for me to go away, but I persisted. Eventually, I got her to dance, and then I got her to smile. And what I discovered over the next week was how, when it comes to seduction, how unnecessary most words actually are. As she and I danced, we touched and played. I played hand games with her, twirled her, made funny faces, and communicated with fake sign language. I held her, caressed her, and touched her hair. We drew pictures on napkins for each other. When I put my arm around her and she leaned into me, it spoke more than 1,000 conversations. We moved, and as that movement drove us closer together physically, we came together emotionally, until they were one and the same, and we came. Emerson once wrote, "What you do speaks so loudly I cannot hear what you say." Seduction is an interplay of emotions. Your movement or lack of movement reflects and alters those emotions, not the words. The words are the side effect. Sex is the side effect. The game is emotions, emotions through movement. If you learn anything from this book, let that be it. Our culture has become stationary. We spend our time sitting behind desks, behind screens, and in cars. We don't move like we used to, and we don't feel like we used to. Over the course of this book, I'll invite you and hopefully inspire you to move, to get up out of that chair, to go outside, to dare to feel, and to experiment and to connect. This will involve getting off your ass, but that's a good thing, and I'll help you with that. And if you promise to move, then I promise change. Slowly, your looks will change, your words will change, and your actions will change. And hopefully, maybe something amazing will happen. Your emotions will shift and move and vibrate, and with them, the women of the world will feel your resonance and come calling. I wish you more than luck. Part 1, Reality. Chapter 1, What Attracts Women? Quote, "The great question that has never been answered, and which I have not yet been able to answer, despite my 30 years' research into the feminine soul, is what do women want?" Sigmund Freud. There's still no clear-cut definition or model of what drives female attraction yet. That's the truth. All I can do here is give you my best theory based on current research, as well as my wealth of experience, and explain what has consistently worked for me. Anyone who claims that they have the definitive answer to what drives and motivates female attraction and sexual arousal is lying to you. The jury's still out. Psychologists, sexologists, and biologists have been studying it for over a century, and there's still not a clear answer. But this much is clear. Female attraction does not operate like male attraction. Male attraction is pretty straightforward. It's visually based, focused on physical features, and more or less universal. A beautiful woman in California is almost always beautiful in New York, Tokyo, New Delhi, Beirut, and Oslo. The variability between how attractive most men perceive her to be is not going to be much. A physically attractive woman is a physically attractive woman. And biologically, almost all straight men will respond in a very predictable manner. This is not true for women, not even close. In fact, women and what attracts and arouses them can be maddeningly unpredictable, contradictory, and whimsical. A vivid experience drove this point home for me a few years ago. I was in a club in Boston approaching a number of women. At the beginning of the night, I approached a group of girls who were not very impressed by me. So I stepped up my jokes and tried to elicit more of an emotional response out of them. It worked. One of them looked me dead in the eye and said, "You're the creepiest guy in here. Give it up." Ouch. Not an hour later, I was talking to another group of girls in another part of the same club. They were enwrapped by some story I was telling, laughing at my jokes and beaming smiles. One of the girls took me by the arm and said, "You're the hottest guy in here. You know you could have any girl, right?" Same club, same night, same guy, same sense of humor, same stories, and chances are, very similar girls. Completely opposite responses. The first difficulty in understanding female attraction is that women can become attracted and aroused both physically and psychologically. This split between physical and psychological arousal is unique to women, as men are almost solely aroused and stimulated physically. This split in sources of arousal makes it hard to perform controlled experiments, and therefore test different factors that may influence how a woman feels. For instance, you may be able to show 200 women pictures of big, burly men and ask them how attracted they are to them. But you aren't able to control their predisposed belief about physically powerful men, the extent of their desire to be dominated, the sexual mores in which they're raised, their sexual histories with similar men, their emotional states at that very moment, their ovulation cycles, when the last time they had sex was, and on and on and on. And even if you were able to control such things, they're so fluid and subjective it's hard to measure them. Men, on the other hand, according to research, with a few exceptions, always like a certain hip-to-waist ratio, always like youthful features, always prefer clear skin and shiny hair. This is regardless of age, ethnicity, culture, or psychological disposition. The variance in male preferences is usually minuscule. The second difficulty in understanding female attraction and arousal is that research indicates that most women themselves are unaware of when they're aroused or not. In one experiment, a researcher measured bio-readings of blood flow to women's vaginas as they watched various film clips. During the film clips, the women were asked to indicate how sexually aroused they were by the clip. Not only did the bio-readings return no discernible patterns of arousal across the film clips, which included everything from male-on-male homosexual sex to innocuous nature clips to films of chimpanzees mating, but the women themselves were absolutely oblivious to their own arousal levels. Straight women often underestimated their arousal to homosexual sex, and homosexual women underestimated their arousal by straight sex. The primary researcher, a woman, entered the experiment hoping to find conclusions about what women prefer sexually. Not only did she come to no conclusions, but she lamented that the experiment only presented more questions about female sexuality than it began with. In a nutshell, women don't even know what they want. And I could have told her that. But despite these setbacks, the scientific study of female sexuality has actually been taking off in the past couple decades, and they are making some headway. I don't aim to make this into an academic book, so I'm only going to briefly summarize what I find to be the most important points for our intents and purposes. If you're really into the academic side of things, then check out the further reading section at the end of the book. Subsection: The Ubiquity of Status. In surveys among literally tens of thousands of women across all cultures, ethnicities, age groups, and socioeconomic standing, and even time periods, there's one universal quality in men that they all find desirable: social status and resources. The amount in which they desire it varies from culture to culture and from age group to age group, but the desire for it is universal. Women want men who are more successful, popular, and powerful than they are. This is clear. Where it becomes unclear, and where my personal experience and perspective diverges from the current evolutionary science, is how women perceive power and status. If you look at much of the research, it focuses on wealth and resources. This makes sense for a few reasons. It's easy to measure, it's easy to point to, and it fits a lot of preconceived notions and stereotypes of what women are attracted to. But I think this is overly simplistic. If it were that simple, women would want to hear about your tax returns and car payments on dates, not where you grew up, what you're passionate about, and all the other sappy things they love to hear you talk about. The fact of the matter is, I've personally worked with too many wealthy and successful men who couldn't land a date to save their lives to believe that material wealth provides that much of an advantage, or that it's even the end-all be-all of attraction, because it obviously isn't. If you think about it, the evolutionary perspective of status and wealth is a bit of a conundrum. Because for women to evolve a preference in men with resources and wealth, then there would have to have been an overt way of distinguishing wealth and resources among hunter-gatherer societies. Again, without boring you to death with the anthropological details, cavemen were not walking around with bank statements and did not have houses or swimming pools to show off. At best, they had a little bit more meat and food than the next guy. But that's not much to go on. That's why I believe that women don't distinguish social status or being a, quote, alpha male through material possessions. Otherwise, every guy flashing his expensive watch at the bar would be getting laid. And trust me, they're not. But rather, women judge it by behavior, as behavior is all they had to go on in the caveman days. Other research backs this up as well. Studies show that women are equally attracted to men when they believe they have the potential to be extremely successful as they do to men who are already successful. This would also explain why women find men who display great strength and skills to be attractive, even if they're dirt poor. It explains why the starving artist has no trouble finding girlfriends to take care of him, and the college athlete can date supermodels even though he can't afford a hamburger. As a man, you don't have to actually be rich and famous. You just have to show a lot of potential for being rich and famous to be considered extremely attractive. I put forth that women judge social status by behavior. Social status is determined by how you behave around other people, how other people behave around you, and how you treat yourself. These are the three tenets of being a high status and highly attractive man. Treat others well, be treated well by others, and treat yourself well. Later, we'll see that these make up the three fundamentals that much of this book is based on. The other problem with the classical view of status and resources is that perception of social status depends completely on a woman's values and belief systems. For instance, wearing an expensive suit and talking about your Rolex watch will gain you eye rolls in many nice lounges around the U.S. But if you go to a small, poor village in the third world, it will be all you need. The reason is that material wealth is seen as a much bigger status statement in the third world, whereas in the big cities of the U.S., it's not as significant. We'll delve into how values and beliefs filter attraction later in the book, but the point is that social status is not fixed, it's relative. It's about perception, not reality, and it's determined by behavior, not assets. Just as I experienced in that nightclub in Boston, one woman can find you supremely attractive while another one will find you supremely cheesy. Subsection: the desire to be desired. The other common denominator of female attraction has more to do with arousal and sexual desire. It's the desire to be desired. Or at least that's how the theory currently goes. For a long time, there was a lot of confusion as to what turned a woman on. Random events and actions could have the same effect on her sexually, and there seemed to be no connection. It had long been thought that female arousal was tied to ideas and displays of security, investment, and commitment, particularly from higher status men. Unfortunately for psychologists, women don't light candles and lay in their bathtubs masturbating to the idea of commitment or a white picket fence. They fantasize about far different things. The new conclusion is that female arousal is somewhat narcissistic in nature. Women are turned on by being wanted, by being desired. Suddenly, seemingly disconnected events that arouse women, a romantic marriage proposal in one instance and a rape fantasy in another, both make sense. Both indicate an extreme display of desire in her by a man who's willing to sacrifice everything to be with her. When women say that just because they have rape fantasies doesn't mean that they want to be raped, this is what they mean. What they want is to be desired. They want to be desired to the point that a man completely loses his self-control. The actual rape part, I'm sure none of them would actually enjoy. My experience, and the experience of many dating coaches, supports this as well. It has slowly been discovered over the past 5 years or so within the pickup industry that the more physical assertiveness you pursue women with, the more aroused she becomes, sometimes even if she wasn't interested in you to begin with. Your bold and aggressive pursuit of her often turns her on to the point that she comes around and wants to get to know you. For instance, we discovered that if you took a guy who used to just stand and chat with a girl and had him put his arm around her and then chat with her, even though many women would reject his physical advance, many of them would also become aroused. It's important to relate this back to the original dichotomy of female attraction and arousal mentioned earlier in the chapter. Status attracts women, but by itself it only attracts them in the way that they want to be your girlfriend, not jump on your bones. On the other hand, being physically assertive and sexually forthright triggers a woman's sexual arousal and makes her want to have sex. This is why being wealthy and successful can actually be counterproductive, because when I began to become financially successful and traveled the world quite a bit, I found that the more I focused on my business and my financial success with the women I met, the more quickly they would want to get into a relationship with me. Whereas years prior, when I had been broke and living on my friend's couch, women just wanted to have sex. Wealth and status will always present you with more opportunities than you had before. But ultimately, if you want to become intimate and sexual with women, you're going to have to learn to convey your desire for her. But this raises a bit of a paradox in the problem that every man faces when he tries to seduce a woman. How do you show her that you want her while still remaining high status? Wouldn't a man of high status have women come to him and not the other way around? The paradox lies in the idea that a high status man would make himself appear low status by pursuing a woman. But at the same time, by not pursuing her, he would never get her. So what's a man to do? Subsection: Attempts of the Pickup Artist. Enter the pickup artist. The pickup artist movement is a men's movement that began in the 1990s on the internet. Thousands of guys who had no luck with the ladies congregated on message boards, forums, and chat rooms and began trading advice and pickup lines to help each other out. Within a decade, entire schools of thought had formed, companies were born, and gurus anointed. By the end of the next decade, a multi-million-dollar industry had ballooned selling men's dating advice, ranging from the old rich men selling platitudes such as "let her come to you" to a computer programmer's quote-unquote emotional acceleration model that promised to use calculus to determine how attracted she was at any given moment. No, I'm not making that up. But the most popular thrust of PUA theory was the idea of using lines and routines, entire sequences of pickup lines, to convey a woman that you are a man of quote-unquote value and status. If there's one thing that the PUA movement understood, it's that a man has to take care if he's going to openly pursue a woman, but maintain the perception of his status at the same time. These lines and routines that they came up with were preconceived conversations specifically designed to hit on a girl while simultaneously keeping her confused as to whether you were hitting on her or not. The idea was to get her turned on with your witty banter and humor while simultaneously keeping her guessing as to what your intentions were. The idea behind it was that you can use simple forms of psychology and framing to make it appear that you are high status, even if you're not, and act on your desire for her while looking like you weren't interested. PUA theory claimed to solve the investment paradox. It taught men how to show interest while not looking like they are showing interest. It showed them how to try hard without looking try hard. It showed them how to appear high status even if they weren't high status. Except it forgot one thing. Women aren't very stupid. You can fake conversations, but you can't fake the behaviors that signal a man being high status. You can fake self-perception, but you can't fake how others perceive you. And you can only fake how you behave around others for so long before you run out of routines. PUA theory works very well in just that, theory. It is one glaring flaw that brings it crashing down like a house of cards. Women don't perceive status by only the words you say. They judge your status by all of your behavior, towards them, towards others, but most importantly, towards yourself. Most of this behavior is nonverbal, and most of this nonverbal behavior happens subconsciously and cannot be faked. The other mistakes PUAs make is the fallacy of correlation means causation. For instance, if a PUA goes out, says his routines to a girl, and gets laid as a result, he'll jump onto a forum and proclaim that his new routines got him laid, when in reality, it could have been any number of things that got him laid. The fact that he looks like her ex-boyfriend, the fact that she was really sad and lonely that night, the fact that she wanted to get out of a dry spell, or she was just peer pressured into hooking up with the guy. Or maybe she thought his lines were cheesy and fake, but when he got drunk and went to make out with her, something about his desire turned her on. The point is, as men, only so much of the seduction process happens consciously. Most of it happens unconsciously. And most of it happens due to circumstance, psychological profiles, and sexual history. Basically things that we can never know in their entirety, and therefore can never control. Lines and gimmicks have very little to do with it, and often they actually hurt your chances, not help them, as we'll see later. I discovered PUA theory in 2005, and the results were more or less disastrous. My experiments with it ended about 6 months later when a girl pleaded with me to, quote, act normal next time. So I did. I acted normal, and that actually got me a few phone numbers. So I took it from there. Since then, I've seen hundreds upon hundreds of men making complete and utter fools of themselves by running around reciting silly lines to girls. And the few guys who I've met who have made these routines work for them are usually operating with a very large number of other advantages, which they're completely oblivious to. For example, I once met a powerful nightclub promoter with big biceps and tattoos who insisted that it was his lines and routines that got him laid, not the fact that he was a big, buff nightclub promoter with awesome tattoos. But the point remains. You can only fake behavior for so long, and as we'll see in the coming chapter, the fatal flaws of pickup lines, manipulation, and PUA theory is that ultimately, coming up with theories to pick up women is just as needy and desperate as any other needy and desperate behavior. Sitting at home, conjuring up theories about how to attract a girl in a club is just as needy as buying her a dozen roses and begging her to go out with you. It's just that you're being needy in a way that lies and says you're not needy. That's all. At best, PUA theory acts as a placebo effect to get men out there and taking action. At worst, it deludes them into thinking that they're controlling entire social systems and that they have no control over, and lobotomizes their ability to empathize and connect with others in the process. And women sense this. They're not dumb. It's why most PUA theory doesn't work in the long run. You may be talking about astrology charts, but they know you're hitting on them. The answer isn't finding new ways to mislead women into thinking you're high status and confident. The answer is to be high status and confident, and it doesn't require being rich or being successful. It requires a new mindset, and from that mindset will flow new and attractive behaviors, because there is a way to behave in a high status fashion while still showing your desire for women. This is a way to unravel the conundrum. You can chase without being desperate. You can pursue without being creepy. You don't ever have to pretend you're something that you're not. Chapter 2, Emotional Neediness. Quote, we are not held back by the love we did not receive in the past, but by the love that we do not extend in the present. Mary Williamson. How attractive a man is inversely proportional to how needy he is. The more needy he is in his life, the less attractive, and vice versa. Women mostly don't judge a man's status by the car he drives or how many VIP tables he buys. They judge it by his behavior, and the behavioral trait they pick up on is neediness. An attractive man is not needy. An unattractive man is needy, and neediness can infiltrate any and all behaviors. The notion of neediness isn't new in relationship advice or social dynamics, although I do believe I'm the first one to propose that it's the opposite of neediness is actually the root cause of female-to-male attraction. Here's what I mean by neediness. Being more invested in other people's perceptions of you than your perception of yourself. Neediness plays out by people chronically investing themselves in their identities to receive validation from others around them. Women are generally only attracted to men who are less invested in them than they are in themselves. By investment, I mean the degree in which you sacrifice and alter your own thoughts and feelings and motivations for someone else. By less, I mean that as a man, you should only be willing to sacrifice your thoughts, feelings, and motivations for a woman less than she is willing to do the same for you. That may sound cold on PC, and yes, it made me squirm a little bit when I first realized it, but it's true. Think about it. For the majority of human history, men had few material possessions for women to judge their status by. Therefore, women watched men's behavior. Ask yourself what kind of behavior would indicate to a woman that a man is high status and fit. Would it be a man who defers to all the other men around him, who begs the women to be with him? Or would it be a man who does what he wants, is unfazed by the threats of others may pose to him, and who shrugs if he pursues a woman and she has no interest in him? The second man indicates a man of status. If you're top of the food chain, you have no reason to be inhibited or to defer to others, unless you want to. If you're bottom of the food chain, your entire life will revolve around the deferment to others, because you have to do that to survive. The high status man displays little neediness. The low status man displays much of it. Neediness is not consciously calculated in women. I guarantee you will not see women walking around with neediness scorecards anytime soon. Neediness is felt. It's intuited by women by watching a man's behavior carefully. It's why women can often become turned off at the most innocuous moment or by the most unimportant statement. Consciously, the action or statement may seem harmless, but unconsciously, it conveyed a large amount of neediness. As you are probably aware, women can be needy as well. And although neediness is a large turnoff for most men, it's not the end-all be-all that it is for most women. Ideally, two emotionally healthy individuals will begin a relationship with both low investments in one another, and they will steadily let it grow as the relationship grows. In a healthy relationship, the gap between the investment of the two parties would never grow too far apart, and the man would never become more invested than the woman. It may still irk some people's political correctness bone when we say the man would never become more invested than the woman. But remember, a woman unconsciously bases her evaluation of a man's fitness and status by how little or much he's affected by the emotions and intentions of those around them, particularly her. Obviously, if he's in a relationship with her, he should be affected by her, but never more than she is by him. The minute he lets her dominate him emotionally, he demonstrates a lack of status. He's no longer dependable. He loses his ability to make her feel secure, and his attractiveness goes out the window. Here are a couple of examples. Jim is a nice guy. He tends to be needy in his relationships and has what we would call a high level of investment with any woman that he meets. Whenever he dates a woman, he'll rearrange his entire schedule at her whim. He'll buy her gifts and spend most of his paycheck on the nicest dinner for her. He'll forego plans with his guy friends, and any time the woman he dates gets angry, he'll sit patiently and listen to her vent for all her frustrations onto him. Even when he feels that she's being irrational or treating him unfairly, he won't say anything because he doesn't want her to be upset. As a result, Jim's girlfriends rarely respect him, and sooner or later, usually sooner, they dump him. When Jim gets dumped, he becomes distraught and depressed. He's often inconsolable and drinks too much. Usually, he doesn't feel better again until he meets another woman, and the entire cycle repeats itself. Then there's Jeff. Jeff's been successful with women for his entire life and has a very low level of identity investment in them. Jeff enjoys going out with his friends and pays no attention to whether the women around him approve of him or not. Often, he annoys or offends some girls, but since he's not paying attention to what they think of him, it doesn't really bother him. But other times, girls become very attracted to Jeff. When Jeff notices, if he finds the girl attractive, he'll take their number or ask them out. When he takes them out, he takes them to a park down the street from his flat. He then sits there and chats with them for a while, and if he doesn't like them, he'll get up and leave. If he does like them, he might take them to grab a beer. If at any point she decides she doesn't like him and leaves, Jeff doesn't really mind. He figures that he wouldn't have been happy with her anyway, so why change himself to please her? Jeff ends up sleeping with a lot of women. His phone is constantly ringing with texts from them, but he only answers them when he feels like it. He's never rude or nasty, but he only makes time for the ones he genuinely enjoys spending time with. Jim has a high level of investment with women he meets and dates. He's very needy, and he immediately enslaves the little of his identity that he has to whatever he believes will make women like him. Jeff, on the other hand, has a very low level of investment. He's very content with his life and proud of who he is. He's not needy. If a woman doesn't appreciate that, then he figures he's better off without her. Women, as if with a sixth sense, detect Jeff's low level of emotional investment. Within moments of speaking to him, and often before even often before even speaking to him, they sense that not only does he have a strong sense of identity, but he's unwilling to compromise that identity for her. This subcommunicates his high status to them and elicits attraction. Ask women and they will tell you. They can immediately tell if a man's quote-unquote got it or if he doesn't. They don't know what it is, but they know if he has it or not. That it that they intuitively know in their gut the second they see him walk or hear him talk or look him in the eye is his level of neediness, how much he's invested in her opinion of him versus his own. It is often referred to as confidence or self-esteem or being dominant. None of these terms are wrong per se, but they've been used in so many contexts and have so many definitions that I've forgotten them in favor of calling it exactly what it is, not being needy. If this all seems very impractical so far, don't worry. The majority of this book is based on how to get it and how to convey it to women immediately, regardless of what you actually say or do. Subtitle: The Seduction Process. Women have a lot more to lose than men when it comes to sex. As a result, they're usually far pickier in choosing their sexual partners. Whereas most men will stick it in just about anything if given the proper opportunity and context, women hold out, often against their own urges, to make sure that they feel comfortable and secure with the man before they have sex with him. That feeling of comfort and security is once she realizes that she's with an attractive man who demonstrates desire for her. Biologically, this indicates to her that this is a man of status and security. It represents a man who is dependable, who won't waver when confronted with difficult situations and emotional stress, who will stick by her and her children through thick and thin. Because men value sex more than women at the beginning of the relationship, women tend to be less invested and less needy early in the interaction. When a man approaches her and induces her to become more invested than he is, this is the process of seduction. Once she's more invested in him than he is in her, sex occurs as a side effect of that emotional investment. Evolutionarily speaking, a man's biggest biological concern is raising children who are not his own, and a woman's biggest biological concern is inducing a man to commit to her and her children. This is a byproduct of how human sexuality functions and evolves. Men are capable of impregnating hundreds of women over the course of a lifetime, and historically have been more capable of accumulating resources. Women, on the other hand, can guarantee a man his children are his in return for his commitment. A man who is highly invested and needy before sex indicates that he's unreliable. If he's willing to bend his will and emotions to such an extent just to have sex with her, then he's indicating that he's unlikely to be dependable or non-needy after sex. Whereas a man who's non-needy around sex, but still demonstrates desire for the woman he's with, makes her feel secure in the fact that he's choosing her from a place of control and security and not to fill some hole of validation. When boy meets girl, there are two ways for the seduction process to occur. Boy gives girl the impression that he's less invested in her than he is, or boy demonstrates that he actually is less invested than she is. The first method, giving a false impression, occurs through flirtation and a man displaying his best qualities about himself. It can also occur through outright manipulation and lying. The second method, him demonstrating less investment, is a passive process that he does within himself and that permeates every aspect of his behavior. Traditionally, male dating advice is focused on either one or the other. The first method is populated by pickup tactics, lines, routines, gimmicks, and displays of value meant to conjure up a sense that the woman is actually more invested in him than she actually is. The second method is populated by generic advice and confidence and self-development, or quote-unquote, inner game. Both methods work, although the first is a short-term solution and the second is a long-term solution. And generally, once the second method is accomplished, the first begins to happen on its own. How this process of investment plays out in real-life scenarios is best demonstrated by some examples I've come across and guys I've worked with. My guess is a lot of what happens in these examples will resonate with your own experience. The names are changed and some details are added for effect. When Ryan was in college, he was a leading member of his fraternity. He was in charge of organizing his house's parties. He was a gregarious guy and liked by most people. At one of these parties, he met Jane. Jane took an immediate liking to Ryan, and the two began dating. Ryan would organize and throw his parties. Jane would come and bring her friends. They shared stories, experiences, and interests. The rest of college went on like this. After they graduated, Ryan took a job at a bank. Jane got involved in a local charity. Ryan's social network disappeared, and his long hours at work killed any desire for him to go out and make new friends. He began to spend more and more time with Jane. They usually just watched movies and shared a bottle of wine. As time went on, Jane became more and more involved in her charity events and began traveling to help with fundraisers. Ryan would spend this time alone watching TV or maybe grabbing a beer with one of his old buddies, but it wasn't the same. After another year, Ryan would openly complain to Jane about her trips. Jane obviously sympathized with Ryan, but she felt pressured and resented him for putting that kind of pressure on him. They began to fight more often. Ryan gained weight. Jane spent more time working away from home. Ryan decided to plan a lavish trip for the two of them to the Caribbean. He could use some much-needed time away from work, and it would infuse their relationship with some excitement and passion that it sorely needed. The trip returned the romance to the two briefly. But upon returning home, reality began to set in once again. Within a few months, it was back to business as usual. Him overworked and irritable, her distancing herself and traveling. Ryan began talking about marriage. Jane was hesitant. She cited that her job was getting busier and that she didn't know how much she'd be around to plan the wedding. Ryan had been saving much of his money to buy her a ring. Jane lamented that they were still young and hadn't really experienced much of life. Secretly, in the back of her mind, she couldn't shake the feeling that Ryan was terrified of that, experiencing life, and marrying her was just another way for him to escape it. Dejected, a few weeks later, Ryan began to complain that Jane spent too much time with her friends and at work. Indeed, Jane had been staying at work until way into the night, even on days when she didn't have to. Ryan began pressuring Jane to move in together, but again she resisted, this time fervently. Ryan exploded. He had been giving up everything for her the past few years, and she had been nothing but ungrateful. She retorted that Ryan had been suffocating her with his demands for attention and affection. Jane dumped him on the spot. There's a good chance the above story sounds familiar to you. You or one of your friends or family members have probably gone through the same process as Ryan. Meet girl in a situation of low emotional investment and low neediness. Entered relationship with said girl. Gradually invested more and more until girl leaves you and dates a guy who's less invested. Here's another story that may sound familiar to you, but it's just as important. Daniel is 24 years old and trying to get over a 3-year dry spell. It's the first time he's pursued women since his only girlfriend dumped him 3 years ago. Daniel goes out to a bar one night and approaches Stacy. Daniel approaches her with what seems like an innocuous question about drunk guys getting in fights. She responds and he follows it up with a number of quirky lines to soon get her laughing. These are lines and questions that Daniel learned from reading a book on women. Daniel has been practicing the tactics for a while and has recently become proficient at using them. After facing countless rejections, he's finally able to get a girl's phone number and even a few dates. He continues to talk to Stacy throughout a lot of the night about preordained topics he's comfortable with. He's able to punctuate each lull with the tried and tested jokes that he's used dozens of times. Every time, Stacy laughs on cue. He puts his arm around her and she leans into him. A week later, after some fun texting, Stacy meets up with Daniel for a date. Once again, Daniel executes everything he's learned. Stick to topics about her passions, move her from venue to venue, never sit across from her but next to her, use the planned excuse to get back to his place, etc. There are hiccups along the way, but it all more or less works. Stacy seems genuinely attracted, and when Daniel finally works up the nerve to kiss her, she kisses back enthusiastically. Daniel is ecstatic. He feels like the months of hard work have finally paid off. The second date goes similarly. Daniel manages to get Stacy back to his apartment, where fumbling through his excitement, he has sex with her. Daniel is on cloud nine, delirious with excitement. He jumps online to his favorite pickup forums and writes up a post detailing how his tactics and lines worked and how everyone else should start using them. Little does Daniel realize that it wasn't his lines or tricks that Stacy fell for. It was the endearing way he laughed at himself whenever he was self-conscious. She thought it was cute and reminded her of her first boyfriend. She decided Daniel probably hadn't been with a girl in a while and that she wanted to feel needed by someone, so she decided to help him. Daniel continues to go out and run his quote-unquote game, but he's always excited to see Stacy again. They see each other a few more times over the ensuing weeks, but something changes. Since he's already had sex with her, Daniel stops running his lines and tactics that he learned. He slowly reverts back to his normal self, his needy self. It begins subtly with him agreeing with everything she says, followed by a sudden inability to come up with new and interesting topics of conversation. What used to be a vibrant and hilarious bantering has now turned into Stacy showing up, saying whatever she wants, and Daniel more or less agreeing with her until it's time to have sex. Really bad sex. One day, Daniel texts Stacy about meeting up with him that weekend. She was busy studying for a test that night and didn't reply. Daniel begins to get very insecure about why she's not responding. He gets on a message board and makes a post about it. The next day, there are numerous replies with all sorts of anti-flake strategies and possible reasons that she's not talking to him anymore. He decides to text her some of these anti-flake texts that involve some silly lines and a playful tease. Again, she doesn't respond. Daniel gets even more upset. The next day, after her test, Stacy sees her phone and notices four new texts from Daniel. The first one is casual, but each one gets progressively weirder and nonsensical. Stacy is turned off, but willing to overlook it and replies that she was busy taking a test, but could see that Daniel was and could see Daniel that weekend. But Daniel's not so easily fooled. He's not about to reward Stacy's quote unquote shit test by immediately hanging out with her. He's read theories on punishing women for quote-unquote bad behavior. So he waits a few hours and then texts Stacy that she's too late and he's already made other plans with other people. She finds this strange and is annoyed since he had texted her four times, but shrugs it off and goes on with her life. 2 days later, Daniel texts her again, insinuating that he's ready to see her now. The condescending and disrespectful tone pisses Stacy off, and she doesn't respond. 2 days later, Daniel, drunk and confused to why she doesn't want to see him anymore, sends a sappy text saying that he really likes her and really wants to see her again but doesn't know why she doesn't like him anymore. Completely confused and turned off, Stacy replies that he's a nice guy but she just wants to be friends, even though she has no intention of ever seeing him again. I can tell you that I've seen both of these stories play out over and over again, in hundreds of different forms between hundreds of different people. Guy meets girl, guy shows less investment than girl, or induces less investment than girl. Sex and or relationship occurs, guy becomes more invested than girl, sex stops, and or relationship falls apart. The first story is an example of why it's important to lower one's neediness by investing in himself rather than the woman he's with. It's the only long-term solution available to keep long-term relationships stable and happy. Ryan's relationship with Jane failed because after he graduated from college, he lost and never regained the great aspects of his identity that made him so attractive to Jane in the first place. His social network, his joy and spontaneity, his confidence amongst his friends. As he got cornered into a job he hated, lost his social network, he began leaning on her more and more to define his identity for him. Meanwhile, Jane flourished after graduation, quickly falling into a job she was passionate about and good at. She made new friends and began traveling, having new experiences on her own without him. As Jane became less invested in Ryan for her identity, Ryan became more invested in Jane, becoming needier and needier. Eventually, the relationship toppled over. Daniel's experience was different. Daniel's story is a quintessential example of why pickup lines, routines, value tactics and the like are only short-term solutions. Daniel was needy and highly invested in Stacy's affection from the start. All Daniel did was use techniques and lines to trick Stacy into thinking he was far less needy and invested than he actually was. And it worked, for a bit. But the irony here is that what attracted her most was not Daniel's lines, but the authenticity of him bumbling through them to impress her. Stacy found it endearing and genuine. She was in a place in her life where she wanted to feel needed and powerful. She also found the idiosyncrasies of his personality to be cute, as they reminded her of her first boyfriend, so she decided to sleep with him. But as Daniel's lines and techniques ran out, the true level of investment became more and more clear. Daniel's behavior became erratic, and Stacy quickly became disgusted by him, eventually cutting him off. But a lot of guys who follow this type of dating advice don't even make it that far. They may conjure the impression for only an hour, or even a few minutes before they falter. Learning pickup techniques and lines without doing genuine identity-level work in order to permanently decrease your neediness ends up only being a band-aid solution. It provides a short, temporary relief from an otherwise permanent problem. Subsection: overcompensating the fake alphas. Another common strategy a lot of men employ is overcompensation. This is often portrayed as the quote-unquote player lifestyle, imploring men to quote-unquote be alpha repeatedly, with little understanding of what that actually means. The advice comes in all varieties, but usually boils down to this: focus on your own wants and desires to the point of imposing or offending them onto others. Exaggerate your dominance and boast of your strength. Go out of your way to make others feel smaller so that you appear bigger. I used to call these guys fake alphas, but really they're just guys overcompensating by beating their chest a little too much. Fake alphas are often serial players, guys who obsessively seek out casual sex, not only regard the women they sleep with poorly, but treat them poorly as well. This behavior is a mirage. At first, the fake alpha appears like a man who is non-needy and less invested, but if you look a little deeper, it's the same old story once again. The fake alphas portray a don't-give-a-fuck attitude, which on the surface appears uninvested to those around them. But the catch here is that the fake alpha doesn't actually not give a fuck. Instead, he walks around telling everyone that he doesn't give a fuck. This is like the guy who says, "I don't care if she calls me back," but then the next day, when she doesn't call him back, he calls her a stupid whore and how she was stupid anyway and it's her loss. But hey, man, he doesn't care, right? The fake alpha persona's motive is exactly the same as the ultra nice guy's persona: to gain attention and affection from those around them. One guy does it by being nice, one guy does it by being imposing and rude. One tries to induce love, the other tries to induce fear. Both are needy. Both personas are equally dependent on the validation from women and people around them. The nice guy from his girlfriend and wife, the fake alpha from the amount of women he's able to sleep with or hook up with, both derive from a fundamental insecurity. That's why it's not uncommon to see men swing from one extreme to the other, both from supplicating nice guy to overcompensating asshole. Because despite surface appearances, they aren't so different. Let's do another example. Roy was a nice guy all through college. He was a geeky science guy, but adored by all the girls he hung out with. Unfortunately, Roy adored them as well, but whenever he worked up the nerve to say something, they always told him that they just wanted to be his friend. All the while, Roy would sit there listening to his female friends complain about their horrible and insensitive boyfriends. All Roy could think of was, "But I care about you, I'm sensitive, and I'm right in front of you. Why can't you see that?" Needless to say, Roy's female friends never came around for him. Eventually, when Roy was 25 years old, he landed his first girlfriend, a depressive and slightly overweight grad student who worked in his lab. Despite her obvious shortcomings, he was smitten with her. But his girlfriend's emotional instability eventually got the best of both of them, and she left Roy after a turbulent year for another man. Roy's anger boiled over. He was sick of being walked on. He was sick of being ignored and hurt. His entire life, women had never paid attention to him sexually, and the one who finally did wasn't satisfied. Roy decided that he had had enough. It was time to put himself first. It was time to put his own needs first. He read some books about being a player and how to seduce women. These books encouraged Roy to tease girls, to put them in their place, and to act cocky and arrogant around them. He decided to try it out the next few times he went out with his friends. Roy quickly felt comfortable dishing out insults and teases towards the drunk women he talked to. It felt like vindication for a lifetime of emotional negligence. Some women were offended, but strangely, this made Roy feel even more powerful and motivated him to go out even more. Soon, to Roy's surprise, some of these girls actually started becoming attracted to him. He began to take them home and sleep with them. At first, the girls were drunk and ugly, but slowly and surely, as Roy became more comfortable in his new player persona, the girls became more attractive. Some of the girls Roy slept with were genuinely intrigued by Roy and wanted to get to know him better. Roy would toy with these women, play phone tag with them, use them for sex a few more times, and then invent some sort of conflict or blame her for something she didn't do as an excuse to not see her anymore. These women quickly got the picture that Roy was not a stable nor an enjoyable person to spend time with, so they would move on. Other girls Roy slept with weren't as intrigued with him as they were emotionally desperate for some sort of male validation. Generally, these women behaved in a dramatic fashion. They would launch into crying fits, call Roy a dozen times over the course of a night, or show up to his apartment unannounced. The sex was often incredible. but it was almost impossible for Roy's own anger and insecurities to not get sucked into the drama of these other women. Traumatic episodes would go on for weeks or sometimes months in a cycle of angry breakup, back in the loving reunion, back in the angry breakup, over and over again, each time getting more intense. Many of these women had experienced sexual abuse in the past. Eventually, Roy would tire of their games and break off things permanently, swearing to never let himself succumb to them like that again. But often, the next crazy girl would be right around the corner. Once again, what's happening here is that the fake alpha persona, the don't-give-a-fuck attitude that imposes itself on the others, creates the impression of non-neediness.